This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Saxophonist James Carter has been praised for his ability to evoke earlier eras of jazz in his playing. He's been recording since the early 90s, when he was in his early 20s. Before leading his own groups, he played with Lester Bowie and Wynton Marsalis, who discovered Carter when he was still in high school in Detroit. Carter has two new CDs. One features an electric band. The other features music composed by and inspired by the guitarist Django Reinhardt. It's called Chasing the Gypsy. Carter plays bass saxophone on the popular Django Reinhardt composition Nuage. James Carter, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks a lot for having me, Terry.
Now, you play bass saxophone on Nuage. Why don't you describe the bass saxophone, which I have a feeling some of our listeners haven't seen or heard much.
Very important instrument. First off, the bass saxophone is the very first saxophone that was ever made off of Adolf Sax's drawing board. It started with an experiment on the superimposition of the bass clarinet mouthpiece onto a keyed bugle instrument of bass proportions called the Ophicleide. And from this, you got saxophonistic sounds without any overtones. And then, of course, with a little finagling and finally patenting it, you get the bass saxophone, circa 1840, but 1846. I feel that a saxophonist really hasn't lived until he's played or at least held a bass saxophone, because it's the mother instrument pretty much. After that horn was made, all the other sizes, 13 in total, were made.
You said a saxophonist hasn't lived until he's held a bass saxophone.
Played.
The times I've seen it played, it's been like wheeled out onto stage. It's so big. I'm not sure if you actually hold it or if it just, like, sits on the ground while you play it.
No, I hold it.
You hold it.
A bass saxophone winds up becoming a machine if it's on a stand, you know, and then you don't have that personal feeling. You don't have the closeness of it, the vibrations of the horn. It's not one with you if it's on a stand. And, of course, certain people can't deal with it from time to time, but, of course, if you can muster up the strength to hold it just like it's alto or tenor, then I think that would be all the better.
Now, you also play the F mezzo saxophone. How does that compare to the more familiar saxophones like tenor and alto and soprano?
The F mezzo saxophone was made by Kahn circa 1928 through 1930, actually. And this saxophone was made to be in competition of the alto and soprano for a lead voice. The quirk of timing that it was made at the onset of the Depression, I think, kind of played into the demise of the instrument. With the Depression, there's a 1-2 punch that's going on, because swing music was getting ready to come in the form of big bands. So all the instrument companies were pretty much catering to that, meaning that altos, tenors, and baritones were primarily made, and everything else, such as sopranos and basses and other sizes of saxophones, were eventually dropped from production, including this F mezzo. And, of course, along with the Great Depression, they had to buckle down anyway. on what was really selling. So the instrument met a precipitous death. I mean, it was sad that it happened that way. And it wound up becoming the equivalent to a crash test dummy in instrument repair schools.
What's the sound of the mezzo?
It's in between alto and soprano. It's actually a step above alto, and it's very lyrical, almost exotic, very great bebop horn. It has a large throat in it that just speaks all over the place, and it's...
Why don't we hear you playing the F mezzo on Oriental Shuffle, which is another composition by Django Reinhardt. This is from James Carter's new album, Chasing the Gypsy. Saxophonist James Carter from his new CD, Chasing the Gypsy. What era of jazz were you first exposed to?
I actually, my first few albums were from the early 30s, I would say. The Billie Holiday Story, Volume 3, which was on Columbia, represented the mid-30s to 1942 of Billie Holiday's career, and that got a good chunk of her and the coupling of her and Lester Young together, and I was very heavily influenced by her and Lester and the cohesiveness that they've had in their recordings. And also Duke Ellington's 70th birthday concert, Basie's Jam 3. Those are the first three albums that I had really been exposed to on a more personal basis.
When you heard Billie Holiday with Lester Young, did you hear yourself in the Lester Young part? Is that what you wanted to do?
I heard it all, actually. And, like, for example, Mean to Me, I always thought Mean to Me went the way that Billie Holiday sang it until I heard this Broadway version of it, and I was like, huh? And it just really put into me the feeling and the nuances that she was able to evoke at the drop of a hat. And it just turned me completely out, you know.
Did you know any musicians when you were growing up?
Other than my family? One particular musician that was very key in me finally settling on the saxophone was a boarder that we had in the house by the name of Charles Green. And he had his collection of instruments at his house with us. And at any given time when the family was on another floor or out of the house altogether, I would sneak up and check out his instruments, in particular this gold-plated alto that he had that just looked like it was eye candy personified. I mean, it was just all gold, and it looked like the golden chalice that, you know, woo! So I had, like, several rendezvous with this horn, you know, in private and all, and I was pantomiming like I was playing on it, and finally on one of these rendezvous, I got caught red-handed with this horn, and by him, actually, and he noticed that I was holding it properly, and so he didn't get entirely mad, but he was like, hey, man, come on now, you know. But it wound up being the spark that made him, he helped pick out my first horn. That's what it boiled down to.
So did you have a teacher when you were starting out?
Oh, yes. And I owe it all to him, really. His name's Donald Washington. And if it really wasn't for him, I wouldn't have found out about the joys of saxophone and how I could, just the joys of music in general. And also he hit me to National Public Radio. So he's hit me to a whole lot of things as far as that goes, and just across the board, and how I've been able to apply it to playing the saxophone and just general life.
My guest is saxophonist James Carter. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Carter. He has two new CDs, Layin' in the Cut, which features an electric band, and Chasing the Gypsy, which features music composed by and inspired by Django Reinhardt. Did your teacher share your interest in earlier periods of jazz, or did he try to push you in the direction of more contemporary music?
He shared my interest in everything, in particular jazz, because when I first started in a controlled institutionalized environment, which we're looking at the fifth grade, we had a teacher that was pretty much teaching rudimentary stuff out of a method book, like Mary Had a Little Lamb, High C's Duet, Hot Cross Buns, and all that stuff, you know.
That could be pretty discouraging, don't you think? You're especially excited about this new instrument and you have to play Hot Cross Buns.
Especially for somebody that just the night before was listening to Duke Ellington's 70th birthday concert and went through the whole compass of his instrument. And now has to settle with, all right, the new note today is B. So you're looking at somebody going from playing, or at least trying to play anyway, and just going all over the horn, and then all of a sudden having to come in the following day. It's one heck of a suppression.
Yeah.
So anyway, while I was warming up off of things that I had played the previous night before, there was a sense of discouragement in what I was playing, you know, because it wasn't along with what everybody else was trying to play. Like, everybody else would try and brush up on what was on the page, and I was up there just going, you know, just playing all over the horn on what I had just heard, you know. And this guy was not at all supportive. In fact, he was saying that at the time my reading wasn't so hot, and it's like, oh, you'll never make it, this, that, and the other. And there's this poster that he had up of Blue Lake Fine Arts Camp, which was a music camp in Twin Lake, Michigan. He's saying, oh, you'll never make it there. You know, it's just very discouraging and stuff, you know.
So I know you went to this jazz camp. You ended up teaching at the jazz camp. I think it was when you were in high school, Wynton Marsalis taught a workshop in your school and took an interest in your playing. What did you get out of that workshop?
He came into town to play as soloist with our symphony, the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. And it was decided that he was going to have some extra time. So our high school hosted a citywide get-together for all the fine arts departments in all the schools. And our jazz band was particularly hosting him coming to our school and just having a Q&A with us, you know, with everybody that attended. And I got into talking with him afterwards, and just chewing the fat with him, you know, I've been listening to this, that, and the other. And he sat down to the piano and started playing chords. And I was just telling him what he was playing, you know. Like, he'd go, bling. I was like, okay, that's D minor with flat 5. And, you know, bling, that's E flat with such and such inversion. Bling, that's, you know. And he was like, dang, cat got ears, you know. So he was like, play off of this. So he started playing some D minor modal passage, and I started playing along with him, and dug what he heard. We exchanged addresses, and that was it. So later on that year, late November of 85, Wynton's manager calls up Vernon Hammond at the time and was saying Wynton would like to have you come down for a gig at Blues Alley in December. So I was like, oh, okay, you know, flame on and stuff. And that's how that went down. So I played from that point off and on until summer 87, and that was about it.
One of your other characteristics is that you're a real snazzy dresser. You often wear a hat, or at least used to, when you perform. Some really sharp suits. I mean, for instance, on the Chase and the Gypsy album, you're wearing this really bold black and white plaid suit with really wide lapels, very eye-catching. I'm wondering if you always were a good and flashy dresser, or if that had more to do with your sense of performance, of what kind of image you wanted on stage.
I think, well, actually that came a little later, because when I first started playing, I had like decent suits and whatnot. But when it came to when I had to coordinate something, I had some wild combinations that were going on. Even during the time that I was with Wynton, it was like I was kind of hit on stage and all. But started paying attention, had my subscription to GQ and all that, and started catching sales, and just got hip all around, you know. I'd say circa 80, late 86 going into 87, stuff started turning around for me and all, as far as fashion was concerned. And the whole purpose for that, I think, was to just mirror what the music was about. You know, even if I'm not playing anything, the dress is going to say something. The dress is going to be that statement, like, you know, it's going to be bold, it's going to be whatever contingent upon my mood is, you know. It could be a tone-on-tone black, a tone-on-tone white, you know, that could just say something about the neutrality in my music or in my life at that particular time. I mean, the just like they say, you know, life imitates art, and dress definitely imitates art in this instance, and dress imitates life. It's just a part of the accessories that are needed to get this music across and to get oneself, help with one's self-esteem. And
what about the hats?
Hats actually started coming along as of after I got my hair together, actually, because there was one particular point where I fell in with what was supposedly popular at the time and had like the Jerry Curl thing and all that stuff going on. Anyway, what days they were and all that, you know.
Well, now that you've made that confession, yeah.
Yeah, that's, I'll go ahead and say that, you know, but thank heavens we got past them and back to a natural head of hair that can take a hat, as opposed to putting it on top of a Jerry Curl, which would have probably ate it up over a given amount of time, you know, because it certainly did a number on a bunch of my shirts and collars and stuff. I mean, forget it.
What does it do to them?
Just makes them, it renders them useless.
Particularly them,
if it's a, yeah, it stains them something terrible. I mean, particularly if it's something that's white, forget it.
Mm-hmm.
You might as well use it as a dust rag or something.
So you got rid of the Jerry Curls, cut your hair, and were able to wear hats. Was it also like a nod to Lester Young or Ben Webster?
It just seemed like maybe a slight nod to them, as far as it seemed like everybody had hats on back in the days. I mean, G-Men, gangsters, the whole bit, you know. It wasn't just about musicians having hats on and stuff. I mean, it certainly helped. But it was just being able to, and it was also a rite of passage, I think, in that sense, too. So, yeah. That's what it mostly was, a rite of passage, by being able to have like a what I would consider to be a big man's hat on and stuff like that, you know, and to finally be able to fill that crown up and to sport that brim. I mean, it's like, whee!
I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your music.
Thanks a lot, Terry.
James Carter has two new CDs, Layin' in the Cut, which features an electric band, and Chasing the Gypsy, which features music composed by and inspired by Django Reinhardt. Coming up, our linguist Jeff Nunberg on the pleasures of great punctuation. This is Fresh Air.